It's Friday, July 30th. I'm Stephen Fee, and this is The Pen Pod, a podcast from Pen America. On today's edition, Dreaming Out Loud. Each year, migrant writers here in New York City come together for a series of writing workshops, culminating in a volume of incredible written works. We talk to one of the contributors, Nicole Henry. Then, an all-new Tough Question. Suzanne Nossel returns to wade through the big questions of free speech from the past week. We cover the Capitol Hill insurrection hearings, Republican flip-flopping on the vaccine, and Russia's campaign to shutter independent media. I'm Stephen Fee. All that coming up on the Pen Pod. Every year, Pen America brings together migrant writers here in New York City for a program called Dreaming Out Loud. The free writing workshops culminate in a public reading and an annual anthology. This year's edition includes a broad range of genres and writing styles. Joining me is one of the contributors, Nicole Henry. Thanks so much for being here.
Hi, Stephen. Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure. So, Nicole, tell me a little bit about your contribution to this year's anthology. What did you work on?
Okay, so my contribution this year is actually a continuation of my previous year's work. It was called I'm Not Okay. And it basically, the last year's version, that is, basically detailed my journey through, you know, my becoming a naturalized citizen or resident of this country. And so this year's contribution is I'm still not okay, because even though everything is quote unquote okay residency wise, the emotional effects are still, you know, still there, you know, still scarring.
Yeah. I mean, what made you decide to participate in the program in the first place? And then what then made you decide that you wanted to share, you know, what is a really personal story in such a public way?
Well, I think in a short answer would be, I think migrant stories need to be told. And so when I was approached by my English professor to join as a way to, one, creatively express myself, and two, honestly, to, you know, put emotion to paper, I thought it was a great idea. But most importantly, again, I think migrant stories need to be told, because I think the average American does not understand just what we go through. It's just a black and white issue for them. For us, it's life or death, literally, you know, or families and friends. It's like stuff that we don't have anymore. It's just a big deal. And so I think that story needs to be told.
I mean, it's interesting. You know, this book in particular has so many genres, right? I mean, there's playwriting, there's poetry, there's fiction, nonfiction. You know, obviously, we could have just asked everybody to write, you know, an essay, a personal essay or first person essay about their own experience. Why do you think it's important that we are treating this from lots of different genres, lots of different approaches than just say one approach?
So I would first like to just say, I don't know if anyone's ever seen Hamilton. I mean, I wasn't fortunate to see the play, but I saw the Disney version.
Yep.
And I believe there's one line in it where it says, immigrants, we get the job done.
Right.
And I personally think that that's a great line, because we do get the job done, whether it's fiction or fantasy or sci-fi. I mean, I had last year's session, there was one person who loved writing sci-fi from an immigrant point of view. And I just think it's a great way to just showcase everything that we can do. Honestly, I think it's a great opportunity, again, just to have stories told. It doesn't have to be real life stories. It could be any stories, but there are some really great creative writers that are immigrants, you know, or migrants, or, you know, just we're very creative.
Yeah. I mean, and then, so you mentioned how other people see, say, migration as a black and white issue. Obviously, it's life or death for you and for other participants in the program. But even internally, like with your other workshop participants, why as a writer, and specifically as a migrant writer, is this experience good for you?
Oh my gosh. For me personally, I can speak for myself personally, and I will mention one other, I won't mention names, but I'll mention another person. I think it was really therapeutic, honestly. My story in particular, I mean, during our workshops, I'll never forget, I would always chat with the person running the program privately in our Zoom meetings to say, I don't feel comfortable saying this out loud, but this is what I feel. And like every time I do it, I want to cry. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And her response is always like, that's fine. Take your time. Do your thing. Like, it's a very welcoming, healing type of, you know, group. It's a really, it really is a good program. I think I was, you know, I've said this before. I've told people this. This was really a great program. It just, you really got to work through some things in this program. I mean, for me, again, I don't know what everyone else took it for. I know there was another individual in one of the workshops who, you know, made the same comment during the class. You know, it's just a great way. It's really therapeutic, honestly. Writing really is powerful. You know, putting words to paper, whether it's fiction or fact, is just a great way to work through some stuff.
Definitely. Just a last question. Do you see yourself going on the path of becoming a writer?
As long as I can write in a pseudonym. There are a lot of stories that need to be told. There's a lot more stories that need to be told. But I don't want to be sued.
Right.
You know, there are so many stories. I don't think people understand how stressful it can be not being in your own country with, you know, especially the last 4 years with, you know, our former president just literally painting targets on people's backs. I don't think people understand the stress, the anxiety, all of that. We need some kind of outlet to release that, I think. And I think writing is a great way to do that. And for me, I do journal. Again, I'm not a passionate writer. I'm not like, oh my God, I'm going to write the greatest love story or the greatest whatever story. No, but I do write things down when I'm upset. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or I think it's really, really a powerful tool to use to keep your sanity, honestly, you know, and especially if you're good at compartmentalizing, and you know, it really is a great tool. So yes, I would see myself writing in the future, but will I be, you know, the great, you know, Nicole Hitter? No, probably not. Focused on finance right now.
You say that now.
I do say that now. I do say that now. But like, honestly, like I remember someone asked me, like, what are you reading right now? And I was like, I'm reading finance textbooks. That's it. That's all I got time for. I'm reading the Wall Street Journal. All right. I got to catch up.
Yeah.
I don't know the rules here.
Yeah, absolutely. Well,
so, you know.
Congratulations, Nicole. Nicole Henry, this is her second year now in Dreaming Out Loud program, an alum of the program. You can check out the third annual collection of Dreaming Out Loud on our website, pen.org. Thanks so much, Nicole.
Thank you so much, Stephen. Have a great day.
After a richly deserved break, happy to welcome back PEN America CEO Suzanne Nossel for our weekly Tough Questions segment, where we wade through the week's biggest free speech news. Suzanne, welcome back.
Thank you.
So let's start on Capitol Hill, where this week Republican Senate leader Mitch McConnell seemed to chastise members of his own party over COVID vaccine misinformation, saying Americans are getting, quote, bad advice. Is that just too little too late?
Well, you know, it's I think undeniable that over the last 18 months, the approach that the Republican Party has taken to vaccine and COVID-related science and public health advice has, you know, ranged from dismissive to derisive to, you know, out-and-out critical and even vindictive. And so on the one hand, you know, it's heartening for someone like McConnell to perhaps kind of get religion and see that people in his district are continuing to get sick and die, and that doctors are, you know, once again in emergency rooms and hospitals feeling overwhelmed and that their facilities are jam-packed in certain parts of the country. You know, if that can waken anyone up to the reality, that's a positive thing. But this is, you know, certainly nothing like the kind of leadership that Americans need and deserve amidst a health crisis. And, you know, I always think back to our work in 2017 documenting the impact of fake news on the presidential elections in 2016 and our analysis of why fake news posed a threat to free expression, which, you know, is not that obvious in a certain sense because overwhelmingly misinformation and disinformation is protected free speech under the First Amendment. But you know, what was laid bare even back then was what a danger this posed to our democracy and society and to the most basic functions of government. And, you know, for example, being able to handle a health crisis. And that was something that we spotlighted way back then as being at stake if disinformation were allowed to course freely through our discourse. And, you know, we've seen that manifest in a devastating and deadly way over the last 18 months. And so, yeah, I think it's very much too little and too late. And it also doesn't represent a concerted government response to the threat. You know, he may feel at this moment it makes him sound good and responsible to be speaking out in this way. But the real question is what action is going to be taken?
Right. I mean, let's stay in Washington because I think there's a parallel story of misinformation going on. We saw really dramatic testimony this week from some of the law enforcement officers who survived the January 6th Capitol Hill insurrection. Republicans, though, still continuing to downplay the attacks, trying to rewrite history. You know, you and I have talked a lot on this podcast about truth telling and telling the truth about what has happened in the past, and that's a mode for some means of accounting and moving forward. But is this kind of commission that's going to take place on Capitol Hill, is that going to effectively fight these attempts to effectively revise what happened?
Well, I think it's an important step because it is creating a historical record in an official way that, yes, is opposed and contested, but that nonetheless is going to have the stamp of a congressional investigation. And when historians and future politicians and philosophers want to try to make sense of this incident or use it to fuel their own narratives or interpretations of American history or politics, they're going to have to contend with this testimony and the revelations that, you know, we've all been exposed to and confronting this week. And, you know, the very credible accounts of these Capitol Hill police and security officers where, you know, you just listen to their voices and you know their backgrounds and the line of work that they're in. And it's impossible not to, you know, or I think impossible not to credit what they're saying. And so I think it's extremely important to kind of get this down as a sort of first draft of history that cannot be wished away or ignored. You know, we've seen these incidences, you know, for example, the reckoning over the Tulsa race massacre. If there had been a big investigation of that incident, explication of it and collection of evidence, and that had all been recorded and made publicly available at the time, I think the historical memory of that incident would have been radically different. And it would have been something that we all learned about in school and that the city of Tulsa reckoned with over the years instead of sort of burying it over, you know, for nearly a century. And so I think this is an important part of that process. I agree. What's disturbing is that, you know, even the advent of violence, life-threatening violence, literally, you know, not just at the doorstep, but crashing through the windows of the Capitol and storming into the rooms, the hallowed halls where Congress does its business, was not enough to awaken most Republicans to the threat that this denialism and conspiracy mongering poses to the Republic. I thought on that day, this will finally do the trick. You know, it's shocking that it had to come to this for them to finally open their eyes to the danger that these attitudes represent. But it turned out, you know, not even the Capitol insurrection was enough, and the debate over this commission has underscored that.
Absolutely. Well, let's end here with Russia, where this week the government slapped yet another investigative news outlet with the label foreign agent, and then raided the editor's home. You know, this is nothing new, but it continues to be a convenient way of forcing critical media outlets to close. Are we reaching a point in Russia where it's just becoming too difficult for investigative journalists in particular to continue to operate at all?
Well, it's really incredibly difficult and dangerous. Russia adopted this foreign agent legislation back in 2012. It's continued to update and sort of stiffen it. It requires all organizations that receive foreign assistance and that the government decides are somehow engaged in politically related activity or work to register as foreign agents, to submit to regular audits, to label all the content that they produce, whether it's podcasts or broadcasts or news articles, you know, with this very bold-faced label saying, you know, this is the work of a foreign agent, which of course, you know, raises all sorts of questions about who's behind it and is intended to undercut the credibility of the information in the eyes of the Russian sort of news readership. And so that has been a steady and intensifying effort. And, you know, what we saw this week is any effort to defy it. This editor, Roman Dobrokhotov, editor of The Insider, which is an investigative website based in Latvia that's done a lot of path-breaking work on exposing Russia's secret service activities, you know, incidents of targeting of dissidents, the Navalny case, you know, they have come into the crosshairs. They were refusing to comply with all the terms of the foreign agent legislation, and human rights organizations and even international bodies have called out that legislation as infringing upon free expression and press freedom rights. And so, you know, they were in a posture of resistance, and Russia is making clear that will not be tolerated. And of course, it's incredibly dangerous for Russian news outlets and journalists to do this sort of work, because Russia, you know, won't just tag them with this label or even shunt them out of the country. You know, they often target them and in some cases kill them. And so it really is the pulling of a shroud over what is happening in Russia at a time when, you know, Putin clearly is feeling vulnerable. Alexei Navalny is viewed as this existential threat. And so I fear we will see continued escalation here.
We'll be keeping an eye on it. Suzanne Nossel, CEO of PEN America. Her book, Dare to Speak, Defending Free Speech for All, is out now in paperback. Thanks, Suzanne.
Thank you.
And that's our episode for Friday, July 30th. Join us next week for the Pen Pod. You can listen to all our episodes at pen.org. Follow us at Pen America on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. I'm Stephen Fee for Pen America. This is the Pen Pod. See you soon.